Preston and Steve Fun Size.
Next guest is no stranger to WMMR, as we've been proud supporters of Rush since day number one, or way back when. And you know what? If you write it, you've got to be qualified to write a book called The Big Beautiful Book of Bass. And I'd say that this might be alone just a pretty good qualification to write a book like that. And I'll let it speak for itself. Just a little tidbit. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome the one and only Mr. Geddy Lee. Good morning, Geddy.
Good morning. How are you guys?
We're wonderful, man. Thanks for coming on this morning.
Oh, my pleasure.
The Big Beautiful Book of Bass, you've been touring all over the country. You're headed to Philadelphia on the 19th. And just to give people a heads up, it's going to be at Barnes & Noble on Walnut Street. And this has been how long in the making? When did you start this project, Geddy?
Well, I guess I got the idea for doing it about almost 3 years ago now, and then I wasn't really sure if we'd be able to pull it off in the way that I thought it needed to be pulled off, mm-hmm. You know, the quality involved. But I put a team together of some really fantastic people, Richard Sybil, who's an amazing photographer, my longtime friend and journalist Daniel Richer, who helped me pound out the words, and my longtime tech John Scully McIntosh. And after spending about 8 months shooting instruments in my home in the art studio that my wife very kindly donated to me, she thought it was going to be for a month, but 8 months later and 30,000 photographs later, we finally moved out.
I love the genesis of this story and doing some research about the book and your idea to proceed with it. You say you're sort of prone to being a collector of things. You have eclectic sensibilities. But this instrument, this tool that you've used to make your living for so many, for decades now, you didn't know a lot about. And then, I think it was, 2012, there's a deal for you to get, I think it's a 1953 Fender bass, an electric bass. And you're like, do I want this? Do I not want this? And was that sort of the flashpoint at which you started to say, I think I want to pursue collecting these and get a better knowledge of this thing that I've been holding in my hands for so many years?
Well, yeah, that's exactly right. I am a collector by nature. I have the collector mentality, or the disease, as we refer to it.
I know it well.
And these things, wreak havoc on my life, but at the same time, they become windows into the past for me. They become, ways of me learning about the world. You know, when I became a baseball fan, it was when I was traveling around America, doing all these dates, playing, 300 shows a year. And with my afternoons free, I would watch baseball games from WGN or the super stations at the time on cable. That was, before the net. So I became a manic baseball fan, and I started collecting baseball ephemera, and that really was an education in the history of America in the last 200 years. So when it came to, as you say, holding an electric bass in my hand, and I got the offer for this 1953 Fender Precision Bass, which is also from the year of my birth. Now you know how old I am. And so I realized that I didn't know anything about the invention of this thing and what was the atmosphere like. Who were the people that were tinkering and trying to bring the modern age into the stand-up double bass players of the world? And so I started researching it, and I started having so much fun. I decided, put together a modest collection of basses that represent some of the great heroes of mine, like an EB3 that Jack Bruce played, or a Hofner violin bass that Paul McCartney used to use, a 4001S Rickenbacker that Chris Squire used, et cetera, et cetera. Well, that modest wish list of about a dozen basses quickly turned into over 250.
Wow.
And I was like, what the hell am I going to do with these now? I have to justify it in some way. I have to create some sort of, reason, raison d'etre. So I also, during my investigations into the history and the past of this instrument, realized that there was no one compendium out there. There was no one book where you could find the answers to these questions about the various models and the various kinds of basses. So I thought, okay, there's a hole in the world of big, beautiful books, and there's room for the big, beautiful books.
Absolutely. You know, and I love that you took the care for the proper photographs, because I've seen pictures of iconic instruments, and I'll use guitars in particular, like Lucille from B.B. King, or maybe Willie Nelson's guitar, or Big Red from Brian May. Of the bass guitars, you mentioned Paul's Hofner bass. Do you think that worldwide that's probably the most legendary, you know, single-owner bass guitar that's existed that people just recognize?
Well, yeah, he certainly that violin bass is synonymous with Paul and synonymous with the Beatles, and the Beatles were the most impactful band really ever. So, yeah, I would say that's one of the most identifiable basses out there.
I loved your black and white Rickenbacker. I thought that was the coolest looking bass guitar. Now, you've been through a few in your time, and I know that your Fender Jazz is your number one, as you've said before. But that was a pretty awesome bass. Do you have a connection to that and still have that, I assume?
Oh, yeah. No, I still have that bass. And you know, a lot of people still connect me very strongly with my Rickenbacker period. And, of course, the double necks, too.
Right.
Alex and I, there's an iconic photo of the two of us, you know, both, you know, strapped behind these monster instruments.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I have all those. And there's a part of the book that I called My Favorite Headaches, where I go into great detail to show the instruments that really I made my living holding, that were part of the Rush history. And I sort of treat those in the same way I treat the other vintage instruments.
Every now and then you'll hear about a musician, particularly the guitarist, who let one get away from them in their tours, whatever it may be, or they sold at an earlier time. Did you ever have a bass get away from you that you wish you could get your hands back on, or have you managed to hang on to the ones that you really love?
Well, I've hung on to most of them. I still wish I had my very first one, which was a $35 Kenora Japanese-made bass that Alex and I painted. We tried to imitate the bass and guitar that Eric Clapton and Jack Bruce had, that were painted by these guys that were known as the Fool, back in the psychedelic era. And so we did our own, you know, 14-year-old version of it, which was a little less than, you know, accomplished. But I still wish I had that one. And in a fit of generosity, I donated my number one double neck to the Canadian National Archives in Ottawa. So I thought I was doing a good deed for my country, but I kind of missed that one. But they loaned it back to me so I could shoot it for this book.
Okay. That's cool.
Speaking about, you know, the nature of the collector and in a way what it does, I love the thrill of the chase. I love that in essence you become sort of an Indiana Jones. You become your archaeology chops pop out and you start to go through these things and do the research. And learning about just, you know, keying off your fascination with this and what you were relaying in a number of the interviews that I was reading, the whole genesis of the bass becoming the electric and precision bass, which I didn't realize pertains to the actual frets on the bass, allowing the basses to be more accurate with their playing. You sort of described the prior to that, that the double bass or the larger bass unit that we're familiar with prior to that was sort of the it kind of made those musicians have to lug that around, the Quasimodos of the music world, because they had this huge thing, and it really was a pivotal point in music when these things came into being. Correct?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, one thing that was really fascinating to me was seeing the old ads that Fender used to put out. Like, there's an ad where they have an old case for a double bass, right, which is this giant thing. And they just put a precision bass sitting inside it, which looks tiny.
Yeah.
And you realize, and you start doing your research and seeing pictures of these bass players that were schlepping these things around the country, and of course they didn't fit in any of the vehicles, so they were often just tied to the roof of the van or the bus or whatever mode of transportation they had at the time. So they were really relegated to second citizens in terms of being a band.
Yep.
So I often put myself in that frame of mind and imagine that I'm a double bass player, I'm playing these clubs, and all of a sudden I hear about this precision bass, and you can plug it into an app, which means you can actually control the volume, and it sits on your shoulder, and you play it like a guitar. It must have been such a strange moment for these guys.
Yeah, yeah.
And not all of them took to it, of course. A lot of them just poo-pooed it, but some of them immediately took to it, and it changed really the course of popular music, and that's the benefit of my crazy indulgence was that I learned a sort of a secondary history of popular music through the eyes of the bass manufacturers and the people that played these basses from the late 40s right up through the 70s.
Getty, I saw there was a study a couple of years that was done a couple of years ago about it was a scientific study about what instruments are most important in a live setting, and it came down hands back that the bass is the most important instrument because it fills the room. It's got so much presence, and without it, there's no real body. That doesn't mean that music without it is not any good, but if you really want to connect with an audience, you've got to have a bass. And you played for 40 years on the road with Rush, and I have to ask, when you would hit those really big low-end notes, say those first few notes of Xanadu, when you go into that, you feel some kind of power. I mean, I know you did it for a long time, but, you know, it's almost, you know, you're shaking the room, you know?
Yeah, you do. Yeah. By the way, that's a brilliant study. Thanks for sharing.
you totally happy. Validate it.
Yeah, absolutely. But yeah, there's no question that the combination of a big low, you know, open E note resonating through a 20,000 seat venue combined with a power chord, that is one of the greatest feelings that a rock and roller can create. You know, it's a beautiful thing, and you do sort of bathe in that moment when you do it.
That's cool.
But you know, usually you're too busy thinking of the next note to spend too long with it. But yeah, it's a luscious indulgence.
Nice.
I was reading about the Gibson Thunderbird. And correct me if I'm wrong, but initially you had said that this was not a bass where you had initially liked the sound of it. And then later on, upon exploration and finding out more about it, and obviously proceeding along with the book, you now love this bass. And you started to bring, in essence, it started this thing that has you, you know, for the last tours of Rush, bringing along a whole, you know, a ton of basses so that you could get eclectic sounds. What is the holy grail bass that is not in the Geddy Lee collection that you are still looking for?
Mm. Oh, okay. That's a tough question to answer, but there are a few basses I'm still looking for, and mostly they are sort of esoteric desires, you know, like there's certain colors of a you know, pre-CBS Fender basses that I haven't been able to find. There's a particularly, you know, iconic bass from 1968. Fender made these two, they were sort of precision bass reissues. That's when they brought back the Telecaster bass, which was sort of the first design of the precision bass. And they, because of it was 68 and it was the summer of love and it was psychedelia, you know, yeah. one of them was covered in literally pink paisley wallpaper, and the other was covered in blue floral wallpaper. Mm-hmm. For some reason, the pink paisleys are much easier to find than the blue floral, so I'm still looking for a blue floral 1968 Fender Telecaster bass.
Hey, Getty.
Oh, sorry, Nick, go ahead.
Getty, in 2004, Canadians elected you or nominated you as the 96th greatest Canadian of all time. And I'm wondering if you know who number 95 is.
I have no idea.
It's Lord Stanley.
Lord Stanley Cup.
You rank right behind Lord Stanley, who created the Stanley Cup. So I just want to congratulate you on that.
Well, thank you.
That's quite an honor. Yeah.
You guys are full of interest.
Hey, Ged, I wanted to ask, have you been getting the itch to write or play live in any way?
Well, you know, I've always liked to play, and this book has been a wonderful distraction for me and a fantastic, edifying journey in a sense. And you know, every time you learn about something new or some different process, which writing writing a book is a whole new venture for me. It expands your mind. It expands the way you think. And so it's a good thing for you. But whenever I'm home, of course, I always have a bass in my hand. And eventually I will probably try to seek some sort of gainful employment with that.
Okay.
I wanted to ask you, because this is your first swipe at writing a book of this nature. And it involved a lot of interviews. And you're usually the interviewee, not the interviewer. And I believe your first interview for the book was Bill Wyman, which seems fairly formidable. What did you bring into that, and what was your mindset approaching obviously a legend like Bill Wyman? Any special techniques, and was he immediately a good subject?
Well, Bill, if you read the interview in the book, you'll see the kind of character that Bill is. He is a fantastically funny and wry sense of humor, right? He's a very funny man. But he's also an incredibly fascinating and deeply talented person in many different ways. He's written 9 books. He's an amateur archaeologist. He invented his own metal detector because, as he would tell you himself, I have very small hands. He was lovely to talk to, but he was a little bit daunting because he wants to talk about anything other than bases. So it was my very first interview, so the first time that I was on the other side of the table, so to speak, and we were in a restaurant in Chelsea in London. I had to keep trying to bring him back to the bass guitar when he wanted to talk about how he loved cricket, and he had thrown a hat trick at the Oval. I'm the only musician ever to do that.
Well, you sort of feel like a border collie at that point.
He was great fun, and it was really enjoyable. But I didn't know when I left there whether I had the material that I needed. But of course, I had that and way more.
Wow. As a baseball fan, I'm sure you've heard of the term the yips. And have you ever, is there a such thing as the yips as a musician? And I'm asking you specifically because of the type of music you guys played. It's so fast and progressive that.
Intricate,
really. Yeah. Have you ever experienced anything like that?
Well, only in terms of remembering lyrics.
Okay.
I mean, when you're playing a 3-hour show, and some of those lyrics are rather complex.
Yes.
If you've ever read any of the lyric sheets that come with our records.
Yes.
So there have been times where I walk up to the mic and I open my mouth and nothing comes out.
I remember
one time I was playing a concert in Leeds in England, and it was closer to the heart, and it's just guitar and my voice, and I open my mouth and nothing.
And that's one of the most iconic beginnings. Yeah.
Yeah, and the crowd very kindly started reminding me of what the lyrics were, and so I got back into the group.
They'll help you out when you need them that.
Yeah.
Speaking of baseball, two more book ideas, Getty, since you're now an author. Big Beautiful Book of Baseball.
Yeah.
Or, being a wine aficionado, The Big Beautiful Book of Booze.
Yeah, or Burgundy. Yeah.
Classier way to
approach. Good ideas, but, there are books on baseball by more respected writers than myself, and there are lots of books on wine, but the bass guitar, I felt, was the right thing for me to go out and create a book for, because I actually feel like I've held that instrument in my hand for over 45 years. So.
Hey, I wanted to mention, I've watched Beyond the Lighted Stage probably a dozen times. Great documentary about the band. Just want to tell you, your mother is adorable. She's the sweetest thing. You can tell she raised a good boy and did it mainly on her own, and that's a wonderful thing. Now, didn't she and Dave Grohl's mom start to have a relationship together? Because I know she wrote a book about rock moms.
No, absolutely. They're pals. And, my family and the Grohl family have gotten quite close over the years, and largely due to Jenny Grohl, because she wrote that book about rock moms, and she came up here to meet my mom and interview her, and they just got on like a house on fire. And they still communicate, and they were just up here recently doing a talk. Jenny was doing a talk on her book with Dave. even. So they were all over at the house. So, yeah, it's a lovely thing that these two found each other. And, you know, my mom's older, of course, than Ginny, but she's really a very sweet lady. And the way Dave treats my mom is just, I mean, he is really one of the good guys, I got to tell you.
That's very cool.
I have to assume at this point, and we know that, you know, Dave is a huge fan. There's, you have so many fans, and the term fanboy is very applicable because, you know, I'm sure you have encountered or you have a certain radar when it comes to people approaching you and who might lapse into absolute adoration. You know, do you does it get old? Are you always flattered by it? How, you know, because there's a certain level of fandom that I think surrounds you and your band in particular that sort of transcends a lot of other bands. How do you handle that?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question. When I started to plan the promotion of this book, of course, the idea of book signings came up, which is sort of a traditional thing that authors do. And there were so many ideas. There were so many complicated ways of handling it. People were trying to protect me in certain ways. And in the end, it all got very tiresome. I said, look, let's just do a few of these things and see how they go.
Right.
And I started planning a few of them and showing up, not knowing what to expect. And, you know, I found lineups of Rush fans. And I have found, honestly, the whole experience so lovely. And meeting these folks, they're so appreciative of the 2 minutes they get with me just to speak their mind and to share some of their Rush history with me. And it's been wonderful.
Oh, that's great.
There have been very few people that I've met in the course of all the signings I've done that have been, you know, a bit uncomfortable. But, you know... For the large part of it, it's a very meaningful moment for them, and it turns into a very meaningful moment for me, so I've really enjoyed it.
Wonderful. The 19th, Getty's going to be in town at the Barnes & Noble, Walnut Street in Philadelphia. And also, Getty, I want to remind people that Cinema Strangiato is coming out. It's there's one-night screening that's happening at different movie theaters around the country on August 21st, and this is a new documentary, or is it mainly just cover... the R40, that final tour.
Yeah, what it is basically kind of a way of celebrating the R40 tour in a sense on the big screen. It's taken a lot of stuff that fans might have seen on that video, the concert footage, but it's added a few twists to it. There's some soundcheck footage. There's some pieces that people haven't seen and haven't been released, and there are interviews with various musicians, blah, blah, blahing about us. And so, you know, I think the intent of the record company in that regard was to just to create something that you can't have at home.
Yeah.
You know, going into a venue with a ton of other like-minded Rush fans and, you know, celebrating the final tour, as it were.
I haven't had a chance to read the book, and I can't wait to, but I do have a question. There doesn't happen to be a section with Paul Rudd called Slapping the Bass.
No, but you have no idea how many times I've had to write that phrase.
I'm sure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I love that he has kind of become a part of your family that way, because he's such a great guy.
He is a super, super guy.
Awesome. All right, well, the book signing, Barnes & Noble on Walnut Street on the 19th, and we're going to be giving some tickets away this morning, and that'll be, I believe, at 5 o'clock. I'll double-check on the time and make sure everybody knows the info. Getty, we're huge fans. Congratulations on the success of this book, and hope you enjoy your time here in Philadelphia.
Thank you much, guys. I really appreciate talking to you.
No problem. Getty Lee, ladies and gentlemen. Wow.
I couldn't have been any better.
Wow,
man.
Wow,
what
wow.
A nice guy.
Oh, my God.
Let me ask you, when you talk to a hero like that, and they're as nice as he is, and as Canadian as he is, does it change your perception of having him up on a pedestal at all?
I think we could be best friends.
That's what I'm asking.
I really, no.
It humanizes them.
It really does.
And I think, for me, if I may jump in here, Preston, it raises them up even more.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I agree.
A nice, pleasant conversationalist, you know, and whereas in the converse situation, someone that you hold up who is taciturn and cold. It destroys it. Here, it just embellishes.
Yeah. I didn't fanboy on him. I was thinking about it, and I have met him a couple of times, and he's been very, very pleasant, and actually sat in on an interview with Pierre when Pierre had one of them. He was nice enough to invite me in on the interview.
You ever see The Terminator?
But I was thinking about what I get from the band's music, and I just, you know, I would like to relay that to Getty, but he's heard it before, and I'm just a guy to him, and it'd be no big deal. But I was just thinking about all the enjoyment over the years that I've gotten out of their music. And Casey, the same thing could be said for Phish for you, Steve for Steely Dan, or for Genesis, or the bands that you really, really love, Nick Pearl Jam and
BTS.
All that.
BTS.
And BTS. Yeah. No, man, I've gotten enjoyment, I've gotten emotion, I've gotten musical intrigue from how precise and amazing and creative they are. I've gotten great advice. But more than anything, out of Rush's music, I've gotten great stories. Because the way Neil would write lyrically, I'm blown away. I can either sit there and I can either focus on Neil's incredible drumming, or I can focus on Getty's amazing musicianship overall, or Alex's incredible and inventive, creative ways on the guitar, or the message or the story or whatever it is. And I can focus on one of those at a time. And there are a lot of great stories that have been written in that music over the years. And the same can be said for your favorite band. My favorite band are the Beatles. And obviously, I get all of that from them as well, you know?
Well,
but it's just great. It's music is so awesome.
You
love it.
When you want to fanboy out, because Time Stand Still is in the pantheon of great, great songs that mean the world to me. Whenever you, to me, every time I hear that song, it's a correction of how to approach life and to savor each moment.
Yes.
And that is actually, on a technical level, it's probably one of the more simple songs that they do, and it speaks volumes to me. I know you feel the same way about it.
Yeah.
It's just a great song that gets you at a gut level. But again, he's heard it countless times.
Sure.
You
know. Yep.
I enjoyed listening to that interview, guys. I thought it was a really good interview.
Sorry, I kind of
no.
Took over, but
this was for you. Oh. And Marissa was able to isolate, she thinks, a pretty special part of the interview.
Okay, here we go.
Hang on. That's a brilliant study. Thanks for sharing.
There you go. So I brought up something that he really appreciated. Got to punch myself on the arm. Way to go,
way
buddy.
To go, bud.
Nice job. I do want to mention that we have a chance for you to win tickets to actually the Cut the Line passes this book signing and a copy of Getty's book. We have a video on our social media. It's on Instagram and it's on Twitter, I believe. I don't know about Facebook as well. But anyhow, it's me air drumming to a Rush song. And if you can identify what that song is simply by my gesturing.
So, now, because he's Canadian and they're all very courteous, a Cut the Line pass means you stay exactly where you are. But that's just the idea.
Yeah. So just keep that in mind.
No, you do actually get to Cut the Line.
Get the whole Preston and Steve Show or the Bizarre Files podcast at PrestonandSteve.com.